All right. All right. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to my talk about C# language internals. It's great to see that many people. It seems like I'm booked in this room for 4 sessions this year, so I don't know whether it's always going to be the same people, but I may start recognizing some faces. How many of you were actually here last year or the year before to C# language internals? Okay. For those of you who haven't raised their hands, you're well aware that like 400 is the maximum level that we can give to sessions. This is really a level 666, as somebody put on Twitter at some point, because we are really going to look behind the scenes, you know, of C# by going into IL code, sometimes maybe in WinDebug, use SOS, and a whole bunch of, you know, looking at assembler and those kind of things. So in case you don't feel entirely comfortable with that, by all means, feel free to either take a nap or sort of leave now. Without much further ado, let's actually get started. The surprise of this talk, as many of you who've been here previous editions, is that except for the slide that says that there are no slides, there are no slides. Okay? So everything that you will see here will be just live demos based on the things you actually choose me to talk about. And I have an a la carte menu on the next slide. Now, a couple of things before we get started. First of all, the recordings of last year's talks are also available online on Channel 9. So you can see, I think about 3 or 4 editions of this talk having been recorded of previous editions, both at Tech Days Belgium and as well as Netherlands. I also have a Pluralsight course now that also goes into C# language internals. It pretty much contains the same content, but the luxury there is that you can spend like 40 minutes to talk about a single language feature as opposed to having to cram a whole bunch of them in one talk. So if you want to go a little bit deeper than that, feel free to check out those courses at pluralsight.com. Now, here we are. This is the menu that I've prepared for today. There's one typo in here that's just for, you know, to keep you awake, you know, in case you know your English vocabulary, you may actually may want to spot it somewhere on the slide. So that's one little thing here. I've divided it into a couple of sessions here, or sections here. I have some starters, which are relatively easy, sort of getting started, sort of just getting up to speed. Then I have a bunch of entrees, which are a little bit more complex, that definitely involve some more understanding of IL code and how things in the CLR work, those kind of things. Then we have some deserts, actually desserts it should be, of course. That's a couple of, you know, little things that are useful to know about. Some have to do with just usage, like NoPIA is one of those features. I believe we actually talked about that one last year, so don't pick anything we've already talked about. But there's this mythical operator called infoAuth that we may want to look at. It doesn't exist in C#, but we can actually build it quite easily ourselves. We have some new dishes. As you may know, we've announced some of the tentative feature list for C# 6.0. And in fact, if you download Roslyn today, the Roslyn CTP, you will actually get a sampler of some of those features. In fact, if you know about other C# 6.0 features you want me to talk about, we can actually get into these as well. And then finally, some chef secrets from, you know, the seller, things that nobody ever sees, some hidden keywords in C#, as well as some very interesting runtime type called conditional weak table that can be used to do a lot of fancy stuff that you may not be aware of. So let's get started. Who wants to have the first crack at choosing one of those things? Maybe you should start with the starters. That's how it traditionally is done, of course. Nobody? What? Multi-threading and events. Who was here the last couple of years? You have to help me if you've already talked about that, you know. Then I will not do that. But okay. Multi-threading and events it is. Sounds good. So what's interesting about .NET events? A whole bunch of things, actually. But let's start with some very simple observation. If we actually go into ILSpy over here, which is a great tool to sort of browse .NET source code. In fact, nowadays you can go simply to a website called sourceof.net, which is now the reference source landing page on MSDN that has actually all of the sources of the .NET framework available there. You can actually browse it over there, including the comments. I've not connected my machine to the internet, so I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to take a look in ILSpy. And let's actually try to open up here from the GAC system Windows Forms. Okay. Now, if you look at Windows Forms, double click doesn't work in this guy. If you look at Windows Forms and say we try to find, you know, the control class over here, and we look at all the events that this guy has, if you know how events work, it's definitely something that wouldn't be affordable in terms of memory to actually allocate space for all of those events. Last time I counted, there's some 50-odd events on the form class. And that's not, you know, the best thing to have around if each of these would actually consume some pointer to some piece of data. Like if you have 50 of those, that's 200 bytes to waste, or actually, no, 400 bytes to waste, in case it's 50. And that's not really affordable if you really want to have that on a per control basis. This is the base class of all controls, remember. Like, you know, on button you have click and stuff, and that's the only thing that people are typically interested about. But we have all of those other guys. So the way that .NET events by default would be implemented is by actually having some field that contains a delegate. And we'll take a look at that and the threading implications in just a moment. But one thing that frameworks like Windows Forms actually do is they custom add and remove handlers for .NET events so that they can control how much memory is used. There is no backing field required here that stores a delegate. They basically get the add call and they do something with the delegate they receive for the event handler, and they get the remove call and do something with the event delegate that they receive. And the thing that's actually been done here is just store those in some big ass table, an event handler list, that's then used to dispatch the events and know who's listening for what. So you're not paying any space whatsoever on a per event basis. If you just subscribe to the click event of a button, that's the only thing you will pay for somewhere in the table. Now, this is an exceptional case because by default you will not write custom add and remove handlers. But if you ever do that, then you have to be very well aware of the multi-threading potential issues that can occur. Like, those things can be called concurrently by many threads at the same time, and you want to make sure that you're not making any mistakes there. So let me start off by showing how C# gets multi-threading right for add and remove event handlers for classic .NET events. So let's just go to the console, and why not, let's just try to do some event magic just using Notepad and the C# compiler, okay? So let me call this events.cs. We're lucky that I don't have that file yet. And let's just create a class program static void main over here. And in the program, let me actually add an event, okay? So the event will be something from the system namespace. Let me just do an event of type action, and let me call the event A. Some people may say, like, how can you actually create an action event? Well, you know, events are just delegates in disguise. Like, you can have any delegate type there, including delegates that return something. That's utter nonsense to use for events, but you can if you want to. In fact, if you have multiple people subscribe to an event that returns a value, it's actually going to be the last handler that returns the value to the caller. But that's something that you definitely shouldn't be relying on. So now that I have this event, I actually don't need to do anything else here. I could even have created a class library as opposed to just a console app. I don't need this static void main. I just want to see what the code is that the compiler generates for this particular declaration. So let me just compile this thing, CSC events. And it says, yeah, program.a is never used. That's fine. For academic purposes, you don't care that it's not used. So let's take a look in ILDASM what this thing really looks like. So if I go to events.exe, we see this upside-down triangle over here called A, which is of type system.action. That's the event. And the way that ILDASM recognizes that that's an event and not a method or something else is simply by actually having metadata available. And what's the metadata for an event? Well, the metadata for an event consists of two things. The first thing is the add-on, and the second one is the remove-on method. And those are two references to methods. In reality, those things are not represented, are not represented using text. Of course, they're represented using metadata tokens. Everything is represented using a number within a certain IL assembly. And you can see those things are also symmetric. If we talk about WinRT events later, in case you choose that, you will see that those things are actually asymmetric. You see that the add method takes in an action and the remove method takes in an action as well, both return void. In WinRT, it's slightly different. So, now that we've seen that particular thing, let's take a look at the add and the remove methods. And now, this is the place where you may be surprised about the code that the C# compiler generates. If you take a look at the add method, we see something very funky here. We actually see a call to interlocked compare exchange. Well, that's something that really has to do with multithreading. It's actually an atomic operation at the level of the CPU that allows you to compare, you know, one piece of memory against some value, and if that thing is actually equal, then it atomically swaps in another value that you give it. So you take three operands to that, you take a reference to the thing you want to compare, you take the thing that you want to compare with, and if those things are equal, then the third argument is slotted in into the place that's referred to by the first. Now, why are we doing this kind of crazy stuff here? Well, the answer is as follows. Many of you will likely have hit this kind of snag that, you know, if you have an event and nobody's listening, the event is null. It doesn't occupy any space, it's just a null reference. Well, where does that null reference come from? Well, it's just a field that holds on to a delegate, that's fine. But, like, if I'm adding something to that, how can I add something to a delegate that's already null? Well, the answer is you have to substitute that field for some delegate containing a value. Where do you get that delegate from? Well, the user passed in one, right? Like the user said, I want to listen to this event using this particular delegate that points to a certain method. So we have to swap that thing in. And you can already start feeling the tension building up here, right? Like we have to swap in some delegate into a field that's currently null. You may say that's just assigning stuff. That's fine. But what if there's already a delegate in that field? Somebody's already listening and we want to add a second one. And now we need to take out the existing event, and we need to combine that event with a different, or that delegate with a different delegate, getting us a new multicast delegate that we have to swap into that field. So now we need to do all of that stuff atomically. We need to read something from a field, we need to take the second delegate that the user passes in, then we need to call delegate.combine to create a new delegate that has an invocation list consisting of the two existing delegates, and then we have to swap that thing into the field. So what's happening here is, well, what about like simply using a lock? Yeah, that would work. Like we could just have a lock, but what do you lock on? If you want to lock on something, you need to have an object to use the lock keyword. But if you want to allocate an object, why did we bother storing some null value there? Like the optimization goes entirely to waste. So we can't have a lock there. Well, what about having one object per class? Well, then you get lock contention. One object per .NET framework. Well, even worse, of course. So we can't do anything like that. So what's really going on here is the delegate that the user passes in is being combined over here with the delegate we already have using delegate.combine. And the delegate combined then gets a new delegate. And then we have to swap that into the field under the condition that in the meantime, no other thread came in and also tried to add or remove an event handler. That's the worst thing that can happen, right? Like, you know, somebody is swapping in a new event handler. We read the old copy that doesn't have your event handler yet. We're combining the new event handler with the one that we read, and we lose the one from the other thread because we're trying to override that. So what's really happening here, and that's what you're seeing at the bottom, is this whole thing is in a loop. There is just a loop here that's a typical low-locking algorithm that actually tries to read something, tries to do something with it. It gets a new value, and then it conditionally swaps it in under the condition that nothing has changed since it first read it. So if we want to write this using regular C#, it would look a little bit like a do while loop or a while true loop with a break inside. Like you pick your poison. You could do something like this. You have a field somewhere that contains the current delegate. That's the field behind the event. And of course, in an event handler, the user also passes in a new event. So what you want to really do here is action new, which is a keyword, so let's just do that, equals A plus the value that the user passed in, that's a new delegate, and now you want to swap that thing in under the condition that the old value is still the same. So what you want to do here is interlocked compare exchange of reference to A, swap in the new value in case it's still equal to the one that we read before. And of course, we need to store the old one here, action old equals A, and then we pass old in there. So if A still contains the value that we read before we start doing stuff here, then we can actually swap that in, and compare exchange will say, the thing I read was the old value. And if that's the case, we can break from our loop. If that's not the case, and of course you can use different loop algorithms here, if you don't like while true or something that looks like a busy loop, you can try to restructure this in a do while loop and so forth. But this is really what the compiler is generating for the add call. If somebody came in the meantime and there's something else sitting in there, this condition will not hold. The CPU will refuse to actually swap in that new value to that memory location and will do another loop iteration, reading the current value from the field, trying to swap in again, And eventually it will succeed, obviously. This is very, very fast running code. Now for the remove event handler, compiler generates the same code with a minus value. Now you can actually do that with delegates. Some people may not realize that you can simply add two delegates together and you get a new delegate. You can simply use the plus operator between two delegates of the same type and you end up with another instance of that same delegate type that combines both of them. And this compiles into delegate.combine and this compiles into delegate.remove. In fact, let me prove that to you. If we go here back in ILSpy or ILDASM to the remove method, you see the remove method does exactly the same, but it uses delegate.remove. Given a multi-class delegate and the value that the user specifies, find me the last occurrence of that delegate in the invocation list, remove it, and give me a new delegate back. Delegates, in fact, are immutable. They don't try to change them inside of them. You just get a new delegate back containing the new invocation list. So as you can see, if you want to use this in some other context and you sort of want to override the add and the remove handler methods yourself, then be very well aware that, like, you know, when you're combining delegates or you're removing, you know, part of a delegate, that you have to be careful there. Like, you know, if you use delegate.combine, delegate.remove, like in the meantime, you may be sitting there with some old copy of the delegate, and in the meantime, things can have changed. Now, Windows Forms, you know, is a little bit more relaxed about those things because, like, it's an SDA, it's a single-threaded sort of, you know, environment that you can sort of rely on some assumptions that only the UI thread can start adding stuff. In fact, in Windows Forms, you're kind of free-threaded to some extent. But if you don't know, like, how your library is going to be used, and it can be used from any thread, you have to be extremely careful about overriding the add and remove methods. Again, why do you want to override add and remove at any point in time? Simply to conserve the space occupied by those fields. So if you have something that has a hell lot of events in it, like 50 events in a base class, and ever a user is only going to subscribe to one of them, then, like, you don't want to waste those 49 memory locations that contain null values. Even nulls take in space, of course, 8 bytes on 64 bit. So that may be an optimization in case you have some library that has that kind of characteristics. So any questions about the event stuff? No? Okay. So that was a good starter. I think we have enough with one starter. That's the traditional thing in a restaurant as well, I've been told. So maybe we can move to some entree. Closures and lambdas, that's a popular one. Does everyone agree with closures and lambdas? We can do two things, actually. Whoops. Not take down the house, of course. Space leaks and iterators. I don't think we've done that one before. In fact, like, if we talk about closures in lambdas, we'll also get to some space leaks. So, like, you know, there's a little bit of a tension here. Personally, I prefer to talk a little bit about stack spilling at some point, but I have an async talk tomorrow at 7:45. Who came up with that? I don't know. I'll talk about stack spilling in my talk tomorrow, so let's actually table that one. Let's actually talk about closures and lambdas, and I'll throw in an iterator for a good measure while we're at it, right? So everyone's happy. Okay, so let's take a look. Where to start? Closures and lambdas, okay? So closures and lambdas, what can we say about that? Let's call that class.cs, and let's start with class program again, static void main. Okay, so I'll do something evil that every C++ developer will dread at. And they will say, like, oh my god, you're doing something that's not memory safe, whatever. And that's the following thing. Let me do action foo, right, over here. And, well, action foo, should I do action foo? Let's do action foo, maybe. Something. You know, we'll see. Return something. And I want to return, let me not do an action foo, let me do a func of int. That's easier. And let's do int a equals 42 over here, okay? So I have a foo that has a local variable called a, and then I return a delegate that will return that value of a, right? So nothing goes to a. I could use a delegate keyword as well or whatever. Let me make this thing static and go to main over here, call foo, and that gets me back a func of int. Let me call that f. And let me insert a couple of spaces here, you know, just that's the human editor at work. Okay, so now we have f. That's a delegate returned from foo. And lo and behold, I can call this thing. actually, I could do something else in the meantime. Let me do console.WriteLine, you know, stuff over here, right? And let me then call foo, and out comes something of type int x, and then I could do console.WriteLine x, right? So that's cool. Now, every C++ developer will say, like, something fishy is going on here. Well, C++ has lambdas now, too, so ignore that fact. Let's assume that they don't have lambdas and all sorts of fancy stuff. But say that you're doing something like this. You have a local variable called a in the stack frame of foo. So somewhere on the stack, you have 42. And then you return something that has a reference to that piece of the stack. And then you return. What happens to the stack when you return? You lose it. Well, it's still there, but like, you know, somebody may trample on it. In fact, that's what I'm doing. Console write line stuff. That thing is definitely going to use the stack. So my 42 in memory slot A that was on the stack will be trampled by something. And then I'm trying to do an invocation of F. Like, what am I going to get back at that point? Well, luckily, because this is a type save and memory save environment, we'll get 42 back. But the way that's actually done is by not using the stack at all. That's the way to get out of this. So you may sort of be a little bit confused by just seeing that. Like, you know, there's a local variable. Local variables live on the stack. Not necessarily. If somebody is actually accessing that local variable from a closure, closures are lambda expressions that close over the environment, and a variable in the outer scope, then that variable is actually moving. It's picking up its stuff. There's a moving truck, and it moves from the stack to the heap. And that process is called hoisting. So this local variable is actually hoisted to the heap. Let me prove that to you by first of all adding using system, otherwise this thing won't compile. And let me go back and compile class. Okay? So when I ildesm class.exe, we see this wonderful looking display class being created over here. Displays are some other word that's often used to refer to closures. In fact, if you compile the same code using VB, of course, using slightly different syntax, as we all know, then this thing will be called a closure class, not a display class. So the naming is a little bit different there. But as you can see, A is no longer a local variable inside foo. If we look inside foo at all of the locals over here, you see that foo doesn't have a local of type int. It has a local of type func of int, and it has a local of type the display class. In fact, if I compile this with some optimizations turned on, we should end up with less locals here. But there's no local of type int. So A is not here. Where's A? Well, we can see it over here. A is actually in the heap. It's been stored into a field with the store field instruction on the display class. And then my delegate that I'm returning is actually referring to, as you can see over here, the native int is actually the function pointer, or the .NET equivalent of a function pointer, that refers to the foo b underscore underscore zero method that the compiler generated that's returning the value of that field. So really what's happening here is that that object now has a lifetime that's extended because it's moved to the heap. So that's what's going on here. And you see A is over here, and you see the method that's the body of the lambda expression. All that thing does is loading the field, and then storing it in a local, branching to the next label, and then loading it from a local again. That's utter nonsense. That's because I didn't compile this with optimizations turned on. If I would do that, this would look a little bit shorter. In fact, let me show you that. If you do a release build, the compiler is really called using the optimize plus flag, which does optimizations, some very basic tuning of the IL code, and then we'll see that exactly that same method is indeed much shorter. It's actually loading the argument zero, that's the this pointer, then it loads the field A, and then it returns that value to the caller. So that's indeed what I wrote. But A is no longer a local variable. It's now on the heap. So that's interesting to know. Now, let's actually take a look what happens if I'm a little bit more evil. Say that in here, you know, I have a couple of other things as well. You know, the traditional example here is just to have a big byte array, you know, a byte array of, say, like 10 megabytes or something. Well, you can already guess what's going to happen. That B, in this case, it's not going to move to the heap. Why not? Because no single lambda is actually closing over it. There's no point in trying to move that local variable into a field. Of course, the byte array itself is always on the heap. Arrays are always on the heap. There's no exception to that. But the local variable is still local to foo here. So when I call foo and I return, we don't need that local anymore. That's fine. But if it would be included, say, for example, in here, plus b.length, well, then, you know, the lifetime of that thing needs to be tied to the lifetime of the invocations of that delegate. So the delegate referring to the display class, referring to A and B, needs to be the thing that keeps all of those variables alive. So B will also be hoisted onto the heap. Now, the interesting thing is, if you do something a little bit more advanced here, say that you have another delegate here, action C, that does something like console write line of, say, B.length here. Now you have two distinct lambdas. One lambda that closes over B and another lambda that closes over A. And now you could sort of like think, well, we can be smart here, right? Like the lifetime of B needs to be tied to that one delegate and A needs to be tied to the other delegate. But it gets quite complex quite quickly. Say that you have 15 delegates in that method and one closes over A and B, another one over B and C, the other over C and D, and then one over A and D or something. Like, the only thing you can do is like put all of them together in one display class, because like there's lots of overlap between all of those sets. So, and that's really what the compiler does. It puts all of that stuff in one single display class. So what's the implication of that? The implication is that the delegate returned from foo indirectly is holding B alive. So you can have a space leak here. What's a space leak? It's just like a piece of memory that you're not aware of being somewhere. You're not referring to it explicitly, but it's leaking somewhere. And of course, when you lose the reference to that delegate, it will go away. But in this case, you will still have it. And through the execution of this program, all to this point, there's no reason for the garbage collector to take B away. So let me show you that that's indeed the case. If I go and maybe I should compile it first, like we're not an interpreted language yet. So let me do that. And let's take a look here at the display class. Indeed, you see there is one display class containing A, and then, you know, an array of uint, uint 8, which is the same as byte in IL code. And you see both of these are actually over here. So that means that the delegate that foo is holding on to is indirectly keeping both A, which is just a value, that's fine, but as well as B alive, and B is actually an array. So that's one thing to be aware of if you're very, you know, lambda heavy or using a lot of link query expressions. You know, your lifetimes of different things you're handing out, delegates and so on, may be vastly different. And if that's the case, then, you know, you could end up in a situation where you're using memory that you're not aware of. So that's an example of a space leak. Now, there's other places where you can have space leaks as well. And they're pretty much because of exactly the same technique being used. Here's another example. Say that you have an iterator. Let's say an IEnumerable of int, returning method called bar. At some point, I run out of those crazy variable names, so bear with me. So collections generic over here. And then in bar, let me just do something like this. You know, let me say I'm allocating a byte array at some point, right? And then I'm going to yield return b.length to the caller. And then, you know, over here I'm going to do like, you know, yield return 42 or something. And then like, you know, yield return 43 or whatever. Now, what's the lifetime of B here? You may be confused again. Like, you know, well, can B be a local variable? Let's start with that. For the same reason as with delegates, it can't be, right? Because you're returning an IEnumerable that somebody may stash away. The stack frame is long gone. We've used the stack for all sorts of different purposes. And then somebody starts enumerating over that thing. Well, at that point, we still need to have B alive, right? Like, B cannot be in a local frame somewhere unless we freeze that stack for the rest of its lifetime. So to yield return B.length, we need to have B somewhere on the heap. So if I take a look at the generated code for this one, we see exactly the same thing is really happening here. This time, an iterator results in one of those classes that really contains an entire state machine that basically keeps track of where you are in the execution of that method. Are we before the first yield? Are we after the first yield? Before the second? Before the third? And so on, right? So that's what's happening here. But you can already see where the byte array is sitting. The byte array is sitting in a field on the heap inside this iterator class that the compiler has generated. Now, when does that thing go away? Is somebody going to null out that array at some point? Well, the compiler doesn't really do anything smart there. Like, you know, the lifetime of that iterator is the lifetime of, you know, all the variables. It's as simple as that. So now I can actually do something a little bit evil here. Like, I could go in and I could say, let me call bar do get enumerator. Let me do var bar equals bar, traditional kind of joke. And you know, say that we keep bar alive for a long, long time. Like, you know, maybe we store it in a field. Let me actually get rid of half of the joke here and just make that into a field here, right? And let me actually store the ienumerator called bar that I get from calling getEnumerator over here. And now I have that bar sitting there, and I start doing bar move next, you know, one time, maybe two times, and so forth. Well, that iterator is actually the instance that holds on to B. So that thing will hold alive that B instance for, you know, as long as the iterator is alive, as long as the enumerator is alive. So that's something to be aware of, that all the stuff that you really are writing in things that can outlive the stack frame, whether it's an iterator or a delegate, those things are really just compiler magic that moves those things onto the heap, and you would do that yourself as well. Like, if we wouldn't have iterators in C#, you know, 2.0 or something, yeah, it was actually 2.0, you could actually just implement the iterator yourself. What would you do? You would implement ienumerator of t, and you would have that byte array, and the byte array has been allocated, well, let me be a little bit more evil here. Say the byte array is allocated before the first yield return, and then, you know, after the first yield return, you need to use it. Well, in that case, the only place where you can store it is on the heap, because, like, you know, between consecutive calls to move next, the first time you need to allocate that array, the second time you need to use it, like, between those two calls, the stack is gone. So you have to move that stuff onto the heap. Now, one way that you can actually get rid of this particular space leak here is, of course, as soon as you have that local variable no longer used, you could do something like b equals null to actually make it go away. Now, of course, like in a lot of cases, quite frankly, when people use link over those things, like they do a single-shot enumeration, right? Like they enumerate over the whole thing, the references go away, there is no problem whatsoever. It's only if somebody is really evil, and in fact, I was evil at some point, I did something like this, and then I discovered the problem, then you can end up in this problem. So what was the evil thing I was doing? I was implementing in a UI, I'm not a UI person actually, but like sometimes I have to do that stuff. So I had a UI, and I had a Control F menu. And the Control F menu needs to move between one position and the other in my document to basically, you know, find the next location of an occurrence of a text. And the way I did that was by simply storing the enumerator over my resulting iterator in a field. And then when you press F3, it would do iterator move next, and it would move the cursor in the document to the next occurrence. But that iterator was actually holding the whole document alive even when the form was closed, because my iterator was in a different space where, you know, it shouldn't have been. It was in my view model somewhere. So that's not the best thing to do. Like, those iterators can hold on to a whole bunch of things if you're not aware of that. For example, you could be passing in, that's what I did, you know, the document and the string that users are searching for. You pass those two things in here. You use D somewhere there, it gets hoisted onto the heap, and the lifetime of the enumerator will hold on to the lifetime of the document. So if you're using it, of course. If you're not using it, then there's nothing, no harm done. So let me just show you that that's indeed the case. To do that and to make Task Manager happy, I'll have to do a little bit more things here, actually. Is it next bytes or something? I need to fill that array because, like, I've done it one time before, and the Windows Memory Manager has gotten quite smart that, you know, an array of only zeros doesn't get reported in certain cases. I don't know what the magic was that caused that, but that the demo went to waste if I did that. So, a couple of little issues here. Control G 15. What did I do wrong here? Oh my God. Static. Yeah. Very good. Here we go. Much better. Okay, good. So as opposed to doing move next over here, let me just do, like, after two move next, I will have read, you know, my array has been allocated virtually the first time. So let me just do console.readline here, right? That's before the first call to move next. I'll do a console read line over here as well. Let me do a console read line. And let me throw in here, you know, a gc.collect, you know, gc wait for pending finalizers. And GC collect again, you know, just to make sure that all the rubbish would be gone, if there would be any rubbish still left over there. And then I'll do another move next call here, like that. No, like this. So, like, after the third move next, you know, there's no reason for me to have B alive anymore, because, like, you know, I've already yield returned B.length, there's no reason to have B alive anymore, but the compiler isn't that smart. So we end up with still having B over there. So let me compile this thing. Let me call class over here and do Ctrl-Shift-Escape to find class.exe, and it contains like, you know, 1.7 megabytes of heap, or well, total memory. Now when I press enter over here, I have 11 megabytes, okay? So you see the 11 megabytes, that's because I just allocated my 10 megabyte array. Now when I press enter two more times, I've gone beyond my gc.collect, but the 10 megabytes is not gone. That's because my iterator, my enumerator, is still holding on to that byte array. In fact, if you see something like that, you don't have to guess where the memory leak comes from. You can simply ask WinDebug, right? So let me just go to WinDebug. And this may be where the discomfort comes in a little bit, but it's quite easy to use. So let me just attach to class.exe in WinDebug. The key I press there is F6, actually, to attach to a running process. And then you simply load SOS from the place where the CLR is located, load by SOS CLR. Actually, this thing doesn't remember font sizes, I found out before the talk. So let me try to change that to make it a little bit more readable. Well, actually, it doesn't even accept me clicking on buttons anymore. It's kind of like a little bit lame. You know, we'll take a second one. You know, why not? Class.exe. I've already attached the debugger, so this one has to be non-invasive. Load by SOS CLR. We'll have to deal with a little bit smaller font, but I'll just do this thing here. I know that something is leaking. The first thing you would be doing is actually dump heap dash stat. And that will give you the sizes of all the objects that are in memory sorted in a descending order. So you will find the high hitters all the way at the bottom. For those of you in the back who can't see this, unless my other debugger has finally woken up. No, it hasn't. The last thing over here says byte arrays. There are 4 byte arrays that have a total of like some million bytes or something. So you can clearly see that's where the culprit is. So the next thing you would want to do is copy that address that you see on the left here, and you simply do a dump heap dash type or dash MT for that particular number. That number is the method table. So that will actually give you all the objects of that particular type. And then you see over there at a certain address, there is a byte array of exactly 10 megabytes. That's the one that's still alive, and like the garbage collector didn't take it away. Like, why didn't the garbage collector take it away? Well, the only thing you do then is you call exclamation mark GC root and you copy in the address. And then you see over here, well, this thing is kept alive by a pint handle, which contains an object array. That's static fields. When you see pint handle object array, that's typically indicative of having a static field. That field contains an instance of bar D underscore underscore 4. If you now go into IL code, you see, oh, that's my iterator class that the compiler generated. And that thing has a reference to the byte array. So mystery explained. Now at that point, the only thing that's remaining for you to do is figure out, like, you know, whether you can. There's no font with that name. Useful. Okay, fine. We need to debug the debugger, it seems. But we can simply write B equals null in this case because we don't want to use B any longer. Or we could simply avoid, of course, storing that iterator in some field and causing all sorts of grief. Now, if I would be doing this instead, we would actually end up with, like, oops, I need Task Manager here. We see that Task Manager has, you know, 11 megabytes allocated. When I press enter, enter again, we have the gc.collect. This thing is not optimized. Okay. Sorry. My stack frame is a little bit longer than it should be, I guess. What have I done wrong? I haven't compiled. That's another thing. That may be useful. But yeah, when you do that and you run it again, and in fact, like on the Pluralsight course, I have the exact thing where you can actually take a look at all those lifetimes and things when they get introduced, when they get removed. You'll actually see that this thing goes away. So, any questions about this particular case of space leaks? The main thing to remember is really your locals may not be local. They may be foreigners, right? They may be living on the heap somewhere, and then their lifetime is governed by the garbage collector. So understanding when language features lift things onto the heap can be something to keep in the back of your head in case you end up having some memory issues sometime. Okay? Yeah. So let's go back to the menu. We've had our entree. Should we go for a light dessert or a more heavy dessert? Whoops. I can suggest a light dessert from the chef. That's the info alpha operator. I'm quite happy about that one. Okay, we'll do the info alpha operator. I can choose something myself, and then we'll go to the new dishes and maybe a chef secret as well. So the info alpha operator. How many times have you been fighting with reflection to get a method info of something like, oh my god, it's impossible to get, right? Like, you know, you have overloads to console.writeline, 18 of them, and you want to get the console write line overload that takes in a certain combination of things. And initially you start doing something like type of console.get method, and then you pass in some stuff, binding flags and a name and maybe types of parameters, and maybe the answer doesn't show up for whatever mysterious reason in the reflection. So the next thing you do is you call get methods and get all of the methods. And then you start writing a link query over reflection to get the right method info. Like, you know, get the parameters where the parameter list is sequence equal to the types of those things. And before you know, the wheels come off and you've been like spending a lot of time to get some reflection info about some very simple member. Well, luckily there is some relief in the mythical info off, sometimes jokingly pronounced infoof operator. Now, the infoof operator, that's actually how the C-sharp team pronounces it. They're English speakers, so it's not that offensive. But like, if you go here, like, how could I sort of get like something like infoof, just like I have typeof, right? I want to write something like typeof console, but I would like to write infoof, and okay, this thing is not a keyword, you see it's not coming up in blue, but I would like to get the console write line method that takes in an int, something like that. But obviously, we don't have syntax for specifying a method with parameters and stuff, or with types. In C++, they have this funky, you know, function types and all of that stuff, where you can sort of like, you know, give you a type, but we don't have syntax for that. And in fact, it's something that's been considered. Like, maybe at some point we'll have something like this, where you can write like, you know, a void returning method taking in int and then a params array or something. And you can already see you need quite some additions to syntax to sort of make this kind of work. But we can locally simulate this using, guess what, expression trees. Ooh. How does that work? Well, you just create a static class called helpers, or whatever you want to call this thing, and you create a public static method here that's called infoof. And let me start by returning void here and just build up from there. So what I want to get here is effectively the info of any kind of reflection thing that I can specify. Now, how can I sort of specify a call to console write line? Wouldn't it be nice if I just would write something like console write line, and I want to have this particular overload that takes in a string and that takes in an object trait, that's the params overload. I want to be able to call that this way. Now, this is a whole bunch of defaults, but it looks, if you squint and if you think about the defaults not being there, it looks like the code I just wrote a second ago, right? Now, of course, I don't want to execute this thing. My program is not going to print like console write line simply because I want to get the method info of console write line. So instead, let me actually put this thing in a lambda expression so it doesn't get executed. That's the next thing. Now, what can I actually assign lambda expressions to? Well, this looks, to me, looks like an action, action A. Now, that's fine. But still, I'm no further, right? Because I can invoke A, and then it will print some nonsense. And maybe this thing is like, you know, you want to get the method info of format C. Like, you don't want to call it, right? Like, you just want to get the method info to do something with it. So I'm no further. But luckily, what I can do is I could say expression of action of A, which is using C-sharp expression trees introduced in .NET 3.5. Now, at this point, I simply can't invoke A, but it's captured all of the information about what I'm doing there, calling console.writeline and so forth, in an expression tree. Now, if I just put a breakpoint there with F9, and I go back in the debugger, and I look at A body, we see that the body over here is a method call expression, and method call expression has a method info. Ah, that's good, so I'm sort of one step removed from grabbing the method info. So the one thing you basically want to do with this info off thing is basically allow users to call it with any expression tree that they can wish for. Let's say expression of action E over here. And then in there, we can basically check what the body of the expression looks like. We could say, if e.body.noteType equals a method call expression, then I can return the cast to method call expression of e.body, and the method call expression contains a method info under the method property. And that's, of course, going to return a method info. Now, of course, like, you know, method info, so why stop there? If you want to get the property info of datetime.now, or you want to get the constructor info of new GUID, like, you should be able to do that as well. Like so. Else if body.noteType equals, if it's a member access expression, which you would get by doing datetime.now or reading some field, then, you know, you could return over here the member info that you, not member info, member expression of e.body, and get out of that the member, which is returning a member info, which could be a property info or a field info. And I could also add over here, in case it's a new expression, which you get when you call a constructor, I want to return over here the cast to new expression and return the constructor property out of that thing. And finally, I'll do throw not supported exception, say that the user is writing something else like 1 plus 2, which is a binary expression. Well, that doesn't have a method info associated with it. In fact, in certain cases it does. You may want to check for that. Because, like, maybe you want to get the reflection info for the plus operator between a datetime and a time span, which is actually implemented as a static method because it's using operator overloading. So you could add a bunch more cases, but all of these return member info from system.reflection. So now at this point, I can write things like, get me the info of console write line, cast that thing to method info, that's the only thing I have to add here, and that's my method. So now you don't have to fight with reflection and magic strings, where you do things like type of console and then, you know, get the method in double quotes like of write line and so forth. And of course, I need to put helpers here as well. I could do the same thing to get, like, you know, the constructor of something else. Whoops, I'm messing up a few things here. Like, you know, because I don't have a semicolon here. Like, I could get the now property over here by doing nothing goes to datetime.now. Well, that won't work because datetime.now is not assignable here to an expression of action. Well, no sweat, of course. You just go in here, you just copy that whole thing, and you add just another method here of expression of func of t, like this. And then, you know, now it can choose between overloads that return void and overloads that don't return void. And now you have everything you can wish for. You can get the member info of datetime.now. You can get the constructor info of a GUID, for example, like say new GUID. And this thing has, like, oh my God, so many things. Like, you know, I want to have the one that takes in an int, that takes in a short, that takes in a short over here, and that takes in a byte array. And just, you know, imagine that the defaults are not there, but now you have an easy way to sort of get, you know, method infos and other reflection objects that otherwise you would have to struggle sort of getting to reflection. And in fact, if you're referring to members that you own yourself, not like datetime.now, but your own method, and you refactor that method by renaming it or moving it to a different class, your reflection code would start breaking without you knowing, right? Because you have the name of your method in double quotes somewhere. So with this, you know, it refactors just fine because it's just ordinary access to members and things. So that's a little light dessert, you know, a very small helper class that you can use to make reflection a little bit easier. Other than a little bit of syntactic overhead over here, it's quite easy. Now, in fact, those static methods, it gets a little bit better in C# 6.0 because you can actually import static classes by doing this, and then you don't have to qualify them anymore with helpers. Modulo the squiggly has not been very well supported here at this point, but you will actually be able to write exactly that, and then it starts looking quite a bit like an info of operator that language supports. I hope that you can appreciate that. Yeah, some things are still not completely working here. But that's the idea. That's actually import static classes, actually. That's the feature that's been added to C# 6.0. You see that my syntax highlighting is indeed suggesting that I can do that over here, but some things are still a little bit wonky here. In fact, in this case, it's because it can't disambiguate between my namespace and my methods over there. If I try to change that, you know, I may be able to get it working. Actually, I will get it working, I promise you. Like, there we are, yeah. Okay, classes that have the same name as a namespace, don't try that, you know, like, it's only misery. But like, now you see that this is indeed just working fine. The only thing I can't give you is a blue color for those things. So, like, all right. So, well, we still have plenty of time, actually, you know. So we could get another dessert, even, or we could first go to some new dishes or some chef's secret. What? Exception filters. Ah, very good choice. Exception filters. Okay, so C# 6.0 has a bunch of new features coming up. Most of them are things that the team didn't get around doing earlier. So, like, you know, a lot of little potpourri features compared to, like, the big teams in C# 3.0 all about link, 4.0 all about dynamic, 5.0 all about async, 6.0 all about all kinds of things, really. So one of those things is exception filters, which we had in Visual Basic all along, and we also have in F#. And in fact, here's a fun story. I actually joined Microsoft working in WPF, and we had one single Visual Basic file in the entire in the entire solution for WPF. That was one file that contained a try, catch, when, and try. That was just to support like filters. And in fact, if you look on a dispatcher class in WPF, there's actually one method over there to hook up filters to the dispatcher's global exception handling mechanism. And that was actually done by having a single VB file that uses a filter. And then that filter code that the compiler generated was then woven in with the rest of the compilation using IL merge, by actually merging the IL files between the two projects. So now we could actually go back into the WPF solution and change that. I won't do that over here, but like, let me show you what it looks like. Filters. So what's a filter? When you look at exception handling at the level of the common language runtime, there is this notion of protected blocks. And protected blocks is really what we mean by try. That's a protected block, okay? And then there are three different kinds of things you can actually, or actually four kinds you can put on top of that. You can put, first of all, exception handlers that are not filtered. Unfiltered exception handlers. That's just catch all, no type specified. Then you have catch that specifies a type. By the way, that type doesn't have to derive from system.exception at the level of the CLR. You can throw any object in the CLR, just like you can in C++, for example. That's called filtered exception handlers. And that's actually filtered by type. But then you also have catch of a type and then some condition over here. And that's called filters, generally, also filtered exception handlers, but using a condition. And then finally, you have finally blocks and you have fault handlers as well. C# supports today catch of T, finally, and that's it. So, what's a fault handler? Yeah. A fault handler is like a finally, but that only runs when an exception has occurred, as opposed to running either in successful or both in the successful case and the non successful case. In fact, we can see a finally or a fault handler in C# as well. The compiler generates it in one case today when you use iterators. In fact, I could go back to my iterators and show you a fault handler in just a moment. So let's start by, you know, showing you the filtered syntax that, you know, we are adding in vNext. So say that you have try catch, and here you do console write line of, say, you know, 1 divided by args.length, and you know this thing can throw at some point a division by zero exception. Now, of course, what you want to do in this particular case, it's a contrived example, is like, you know, you want to catch divide by zero exception very specifically. Now, say that you have something much more complex, like an IO exception that contains some file path, and you only want to catch it if, you know, it's a certain file. Like, you know, it's a file in a certain folder or something. Like, what would you do in that case? Well, let me say that, like, you know, let me just do an IO exception. Why not, you know? Console write line from now on is official. It can throw IO exceptions, okay? So I want to catch the IO exception only if the exception contains a certain file name. Now, what would you do today? Well, you would go into the I/O exception and you would look for a property called filename. And yeah, maybe, you know, I/O exceptions don't always contain file names, but in certain cases they do. So we don't have a better class to sort of cast to here. We really want to sort of look into the exception and figure out, like, you know, is it about a file? So you may do something like message.contains, you know, foo.txt, yada, yada, yada. Then I can handle it. Otherwise, I will rethrow the exception, right? So that's the kind of code you would write. Now, rethrow is not without danger. Some people actually write throw EX over here. And then the wheels come off. Why do the wheels come off? Because, like, when you do throw EX over there, you lose the original call stack. Like, the exception now gets the call stack of where you're throwing it. If you do throw without the EX, the call stack is preserved. Actually, in the very original versions of the CLR, there was a bug there and the call stack didn't get preserved. Nowadays it does, but like that's one of the dangers of, like, you know, having to write this kind of code. So the CLR supports filters where you can basically write in C Sharp 6.0, now surfaced in the language, where you can write something like this, and then you now have the code that handles the condition over here. So this if statement is not an if statement that sits in the body, right? It's an if statement that's associated with the handler and that the CLR will transfer to when an exception happens to evaluate whether this is a catch handler that can actually take over control and handle the exception. Now, the order of operations here is the other thing that people sometimes get wrong. So let me actually introduce a couple of methods here. Let me introduce a method called static void foo, let's say. Or bar, better. So that's the bar method. And then let me actually add over here a static void foo method. Okay. And then let me call over here foo, which will call bar under a try catch. And then on top of this thing, you know, I'll put another try catch, let's say, try catch exception E. And here I want to do also something with a filter. Here I want to do E dot, you know, message contains something else, like, you know, say bar.txt. Utter nonsense, but, you know, just to sort of set up the scene here. Like, say that bar now throws an I/O exception. Like, the order of execution of filters is something that's hard to actually get when you're writing C# code with catch with an if statement inside of it. Because what's happening when an exception occurs over here? Throw new exception. Well, I/O exception, of course. Or, well, actually, let's just do throw, like, new invalid operation exception, which is not an I/O exception. So when this thing gets thrown, the CLR, first of all, will evaluate those if conditions. It needs to find a handler. So when this thing is being thrown, you will actually see a breakpoint being hit, and you can set breakpoints over here. Isn't that cool? Like, you know, it all just works. So you will see when the exception happens that first this message handler is actually, or this exception handler is being evaluated. Next, we will see that this one is being evaluated. And it will just go up the stack trying to evaluate all of those conditions to find out whether there is somebody who can handle that exception. And when it finally finds somebody who is willing to take that exception, then we know where we have to unwind the stack to. So it knows, like, I need to transfer control to that catch handler. Let me go and execute all the finalies on the way, and also the fault handlers. So it will try to unwind the stack at that point and transfer control to whoever was the first one to say, like, I want to handle this exception. With try-catch, you don't have that luxury. Like, you know, with try-catch, you're catching it because you declared you're catching it. Control is transferred to you, and now you have a hot potato in your lap. Like, you know, either you have to rethrow it out or you have to handle it, right? And if you don't rethrow it, well, you may have some interesting problem that your exception has been swallowed and you know, nobody knows that something bad is happening in your code. Now, how does this actually get compiled? Let me show you. I could try to open ILSpy. Actually, it's quite fun to try to open this in ILSpy before it's been educated about a new feature. So if we open this in ILSpy, here we go. I already hit F6 to build this thing. So here it is, filters.exe. If we take a look here in the program, and we go to where's our filter? It looks like complete voodoo because ILSpy doesn't know about, like, you know, filters yet. So you see all sorts of nonsense here. Like, you see a try block without, like, a catch or like a finally or anything. You see some end filter thing at the bottom. Like, they've just made a mess out of it over here. But if I go to ILDASM, of course, that thing can never lie. We can take a look at the IL code very quickly. And we will see over here that the way this thing actually gets implemented, was it in my main methods or where was it? I've forgotten already. Plenty of places. In the foo method, you see that it's not a catch, but it's a filter at the level of the common language runtime. And the code emitted in the filter, well, actually, code emitted in a filter doesn't take in the type of exception to look for. A filter is just something that evaluates a Boolean condition for any exception that may occur. So you see, the first thing that the compiler generates here is an isInst call to basically check whether the exception is an IO exception. So it's like catching everything, except it's not catching it. Like, you know, it's a condition that's been evaluated while the exception handling is taking place. It checks whether it's an IO exception. And then if that's the case, you know, you see a whole bunch of code there that's basically a Boolean condition that's been evaluated. And if that's the case, over here, when the filter ends, and it actually ends by saying on top of the stack that indeed, you know, the string contains true, you know, the greater than, I don't know why there's a greater than comparison over here, actually. That's a convenient way of actually getting a Boolean back in this case. But if I optimize this code, I'm pretty sure it will look a little bit shorter. But what we will see is that, like, the filter will get a Boolean back that the common language runtime uses to say, like, oh, that's the one that's willing to handle this particular exception. And then it will transfer control to this piece of code here, which is my the code of my handler, which in this case was simply empty in my, it just contained a comment. So this is the first time that the C# compiler will emit filters. As you've seen, ILSpy is not completely up to the test yet, but that's basically what's going on here. Fault handlers, actually, is something that you can't write in C#. In fact, like, you know, fault handlers, well, you can do that in a couple of ways. Like, you can have a catch-all and basically a retro from there. Okay, that suffers from kind of the same problems, but, you know, in terms of you should not forget to retro. You can also do a finally with a Boolean check, right? You could have, like, you know, a finally over here, and the very last thing you could say over here is success equals true, and then you say over here success equals false, and then you can disambiguate whether you actually got to the last line of your try block or not. And then you can do an if statement inside saying, if we succeeded, well, then I'm not interested in doing anything special. If I didn't succeed, then, you know, I want to do some cleanup. Now, this kind of pattern is something that, you know, if enough people would ask for it, maybe would eventually be added to the language as well. But that's known as a fault handler inside the common language runtime. Now, C# actually emits this thing in one case. Inside iterators. So if you really want this, you can create a helper class again. And I'll leave it as an exercise for the viewer here. But, like, you know, I'll prove to you that the C# compiler can actually emit those guys. If I do an enumerator or something with iterators, let's call it axis, over here, where I have a using statement, a using block, and I do a yield return inside of that guy, and I have, like, you know, an idisposable resource, doesn't really have to be anything meaningful. I'm just trying to get this thing to compile. Like, you know, over here, when you do new D, this using block doesn't get compiled into a try finally for various reasons. It actually gets compiled into a try fault. And if you take a look in here, because the dispose path, the regular dispose path, will take care of disposing D under any circumstance anyway, the reasoning is not very important here. But if you look at this guy, the generated code for my iterator, if you look in the move next method, what you see here is a try. There's a bunch of code here, like if I would optimize it, you know, it would look different, but there's a fault handler. And see what's been called inside the fault? The dispose method of the disposable. So if you really want to have fault handlers, you can create some fake iterator, you know, that has a dispose implementation with a delegate containing the thing that you want to dispose in the fault and whatever. You could actually trick, you know, the compiler into using a fault handler. But quite frankly, it's not worth the effort. Now, this you can emulate quite easily. Filters you couldn't emulate because, well, C# never emitted filters to begin with. And secondly, simply doing try catch with an if statement has different timings, as we've seen. You will first, in this case, you will have those conditions evaluated before the handlers run. Okay. Now, that means one important thing. Make sure that those conditions here are pretty much pure functions. Don't make those things start mutating a whole bunch of things in the course of evaluating things, because at that point, of course, your invariance will be quite difficult to reason about. Like, if this thing over here has a side effect, like say it sets some global variable in the course of evaluating this thing, well, you know, then the next handler on top of that one will observe that side effect and then will eventually transfer somewhere, you know, all sorts of things. So keep this for very simple conditions, right? Like, you know, if the exception contains something or, you know, if it has a certain value or whatever. If it throws an exception, actually, I'll leave that as an exercise as well, but if you throw an exception from those things, like, it currently depends on whether your debugger is attached or not, but you can actually get infinite loop behavior if you try to do something like that under the debugger. It looks quite funky because, like, we're evaluating the filters. When the filter throws an exception, well, where has that filter been evaluated from? It's literally been evaluated at the point of where the exception has been thrown. So at that point, if an exception swings back in our face, what do we do? Do we take that exception down to all the exception filters again, where it may throw again, or do we take down the process or whatever? So have some fun with that to like figure out the timing there, but like that could be a very good quiz question. So again, better not to throw from those things as well. But that's pretty much the same thing like throwing in a finally block in some sense. Okay, it doesn't get that sort of nasty behavior, but throwing in a finally block really means you lose your original exception, right? So that's not a good thing to do either. So that's that little new dish that we have over there. I could talk about awaiting, catch, and finally tomorrow when I talk about about async, actually. That's also a new feature in C# 6.0. Lots of people wanted that. It's actually quite complex to implement. You know, correct behavior for being able to await inside a catch or a finally handler. The reason for that is like await means that your method may pause. Now, if your method pauses, it simply returns to its caller, like in async. Like, you know, the caller simply, you know, can continue executing the message loop. Now, if you're in the middle of a finally handler, like you have some hot potatoes in your hands again, like you have an exception, but you can't throw it out yet, because first that await needs to complete. So, like, where do you stay with that exception? We have to store it somewhere. And, like, a whole bunch of things that need to happen. Now, one thing that's quite interesting is because now we have the Roslyn source code available, you can actually see all of that stuff for yourself. If we go over here to the Roslyn sources, I'll show you where the code has been implemented for this the new features for async, actually. Let me try to find it over here. It's under lowering, async rewriter 2, async handler rewriter. Here we go. This is a file that contains the new code to support await containing catch and finally blocks. And you know, if you really feel urged tonight and you know you don't go to the bar, or actually you could do it at the bar, I do it sometimes, you could start reading how this actually works. And over here there's a bunch of very good examples of like all sort of like the magic hoops that the compiler has to go through to actually support awaiting inside catch and finally blocks. In fact, it also knows about filters, of course, because they've been added at the same time. So you can also, you know, await in the body, not in the condition, of course, but in the body of your filtered catch handler as well. Effectively, what it means is that all of the branching instructions that are taken that reach to a particular point in the try finally or a try catch, we sort of need to remember that so that when the method resumes, we can sort of continue on our path out. Like if somebody is inside a finally block, we have to pause. We may have reached a finally block because an exception happened somewhere. So we need to store that exception and rethrow it at some point. Or we may have reached a finally block for some other reason. We succeeded. And then, you know, we have to be able to continue succeeding at a later point. Okay? So that's all of that stuff in here. So let's just have, you know, something to conclude with. We have two options here. In fact, the second one is quite hard, but we could do a light chef secret with the conditional weak table, unless somebody wants to see the mysterious arglist keyword. You want arglist? Okay, you get arglist. It's something that you should not use, because it's actually a hidden keyword. And in fact, I'll show you where it's actually been used. If you go to console write line in MS Corelib, over here, console, write line, and you start scanning through this thing, there's this mysterious write overload over here that contains arglist at the end. And ILSpy is not wrong in this case. This keyword exists. It will actually look in blue in Visual Studio. what's this thing about? Well, ArgList is really there to support variable length invocations from languages like managed C++, where you can actually pass a variable length array in. Now, you may say, like, well, why not use like params arrays for that? Well, params arrays have something that some people in native may not like, namely that a params array does some heap allocations. And with ArgList, you can basically get references to things on your stack. So, like, it's a little bit more, in some sense, optimized. Now, in reality, the performance of that stuff isn't really great, and, like, you know, it's something that you shouldn't really care about too much. But, like, when you're browsing this kind of code, you may end up seeing it. So, how does that work? The ArgList keywords can be used in three different places, actually. First of all, it can be used in a declaration to say, like, I want to take in any number of arguments that follow this thing. And I want to take them in not by stuffing them into an array and heap allocating that guy. I want to just leave them on the stack and for my receiver to be able to sort of pull them out of the stack, including their type information. And that's the second place where this thing is used. You see over there the arg iterator that passes in the arg list. So the arg iterator type is a very simple helper type over here that, as you can see, it has a whole bunch of like int pointers that are actually used to point into the stack as you're iterating over the arg list. So we just know, like, because it's the last thing, we know where the last argument was that's not in the arg list, and we know where the argument bundle ends. So we can sort of give you an iterator through that. In fact, things like managed C++, when you're calling one of those guys, can actually take advantage of that. Now, what's more interesting about that, and that's the reason I put ArgList up there, is because, like, all of that stuff about avoiding heap allocations, well, you know, you don't want to use ArgList for that. You use just params arrays in C#. But a very common pattern that people use is what you see in front of the ArgList. That's namely to expand things like string.format any number of times before going to a params array. In fact, if you look at string.format, if you look at console.writeline, console.write, you will see that they're not lazy. They don't say, I will just give you a write method that takes in an object array. Because if you do that, well, you know, there's a little bit of waste there, like, you know, memory allocation costs. And, like, if you do a lot of those guys, like, you know, you will always have single arguments or even no arguments at all. Like, if you do console.write hello world, well, it would have to allocate an empty array on the heap because your ArgList is empty or your object array is empty. So what you can see here is this typical expansion pattern, and in the BCL it typically stops at 4, where you sort of, like, give people those additional overloads that enable you to effectively avoid, you know, allocating those arrays. Of course, what you don't want to do is, like, you know, in just all those convenience overloads, call the other overload that takes in an object array and you up an array yourself. Like, of course, that would be totally ridiculous to do that. Now, I said that ArgList is used in three places. We see it over here being used in the declaration side. We see it being used to pass into the arg iterator. And there's a third case where you actually call this thing. And so in C#, you could do that if you really want to. Actually, let me stay in this project just for now. Like static void quirks. I didn't have that one yet, did I? So I can have ArgList here. You see it's blue. See, Visual C++ knows about Visual Studio knows about it. I can go here and try to invoke quirks by creating an ArgList that contains 1, 2, and foo, for example. And then inside of this thing, I can do new arg iterator of the ArgList. Whoops. ArgList like this var it for iterator. And now, you know, we can go over this thing. We can actually start enumerating over that. And that's what languages like managed C++ do when they actually interoperate with those kind of APIs that take in variable length arrays. Again, something that's a little bit of a curiosum. If you look at those APIs inside IlSpy, you may actually end up seeing one of those mysterious keywords. They're actually couple more mysterious keywords. Another one is makeref, and then we have a couple of others to unwrap so-called typed references. But that's stuff that you can actually only find in two places. If you look at interlocked exchange, you will find another mysterious keyword. So I'll leave that for you to take a look at the bar and impress the people next to you, like, you know, that you found the hidden keyword. So there's only four, and you can actually search the Roslyn compiler now, because all the source is open, so you can actually find exactly where those things are being used and emitted. So that's a whirlwind tour through a couple of those features. Again, most of it, what's here, except for the C Sharp 6.0 stuff, is now also available in the courses that I have at Pluralsight. As we see more talks coming online, you will, of course, see other gaps being filled in of things that we didn't get a chance to talk about here. If you have any suggestions for other topics or things you found out yourself and you said, like, oh, I didn't expect that the compiler would generate this code under that particular circumstance, feel free to send that to me as well. I'll give you all the credits for it in one of my talks. And with that, you know, I thank you for your attention and hope to see you again at some point.